Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Waypoint Sports and Sports Adjacent Podcast. It sets out to disprove the notion that people with lives dedicated to pixels jumping across the screen can't also be unhealthily interested in what nerds condescendingly call sports ball every Super Bowl. Rob, I now start off every episode with a new question. Do you think, asked Colin from Cambridge, in hindsight, the Cubs winning the 2016 World Series should have told us something was deeply wrong with the world?
So I've thought about this a lot, actually. I remember that night, my friend and I was out. I was living in L.A. My buddy from like high school, we watched the game together. And I remember in the middle of all that ecstasy, as the Cubs put it away on that rainy night, they go to the post-game desk and you got the whole like Hillary for prison banner in the background. And it was like, oh, yeah, like reality is like hovering right there at the edge. And when like Trump won that election and then like just the ensuing years sort of felt like we were sliding deeper into chaos world, I did often flash back to that night where it was like one of the last normal lot nights is sort of how it felt. But also the Cubs won a World Series and it did sort of feel like a devil's pact had been struck, where it was like the curse would be broken and then a curse would blight the land.
A generational trauma was forgiven in exchange for a new one.
Yeah.
I have a Cubs World Series story, which is...
Hello, Jason Kebler from Motherboard.
Yeah. Hello. Thank you. A baseball super fan over here. I have a friend who is from Chicago, huge Cubs fan, and she was getting married like the weekend after the election in Chicago. And so I went to Chicago for her wedding. And her father's one and only request was that the live band play Go Cubs Go and that he be allowed to be the lead singer of this song during the reception.
That is a power move. That is the kind of dad at a wedding respect. Like, I can respect that. I'm going to pocket that one. I don't know if I'm going to do that exactly, but I like that as an idea of a power move as a parental figure.
Yeah, he had extreme dad at wedding energy. Like he was grabbing the mic like every three songs or so and being like, I paid for this wedding. I'm going to sing the songs I want. But it was so weird because everyone was very sad about Trump winning at this wedding, but very happy that the Cubs won the World Series. And also like ancillarily interested in the fact that there was like a wedding occurring. But it was mostly about the Cubs and Trump.
It was mostly an incidental event that brought a bunch of people together after two major life events had happened. And like, well, frankly, that's kind of what weddings are for. It's a big enough moment in someone's life to force a bunch of people to get together. And it just does not usually necessarily occur around such positives and negatives in the way that one did.
Yeah, very, very memorable. Anyways, that's my Cubs World Series story.
That's good. The best story I have from that era, other than probably the most conservative, and I don't mean that in like a red blue capacity, just a neighbor next to me who is just very kind of straight laced, doesn't say a lot to you, very nice, has been very friendly and helpful when things have come up around the house or yada yada yada. The one thing that breaks him out of this emotional state is the Cubs, and he is a lifetime diehard. Like, so this win, this, you know, getting the World Series was like a personal emotional high. And I remember I was at home watching the last game, and every time the Cubs would win during that, at least that 2016 season, that he would put up, he's got his Cubs W, you know, like flag. It would go in the front of his house. Like he'd stake it out there during everyone. And after that game, after they won that final game and won the World Series, I heard a scream, a guttural one. And I was like, how could I even hear a scream from a neighbor's house unless they were truly in danger? Well, he wasn't in danger, but he had left his house and began running up and down the street as though he was Will Ferrell in Old School. And I have never since seen that level of emotion from this person because they seem genuinely incapable of it. And yet I think it goes to show like the power and emotional spirit of sports that it can drag someone like that to a state like that. And then they just immediately revert back into their shell. Tangentially is we just had our oldest daughter right around when this was happening. She was born in late August. So this is all happening in October. And we're like, well, we should go watch at least one of the two games, like, you know, out at a bar. And so we'd go to this place that was like comfortable enough to bring a newborn to and had a little spot to sit. And I think it was game 3 or 4. I don't know where it was in the order of things. But all I know is that I just ordered a beer and the like server came up to see if like anyone else needed anything else. And I looked around and the newborn was asleep and my wife was asleep. And it was like the fourth inning. And I said, I'll just take the check and finish this beer as fast as possible. If two of the women that I'm here are with are sleeping, maybe I should go watch the game at home. But we have you here, Jason, because opening day just occurred last week in the MLB. It comes with a season that has some pretty substantial, would it be wrong to say it's the most substantial rule changes to the sport in a long time between the changes to the defensive shift, the introduction of the pitch clock, and obviously those big puffy pillows that are they're calling bases. I know this has been like when we asked people for questions, a lot of what came in was questions about some of the rule changes. Can you like for Rob and I, we like to drink beer and watch baseball and claim that we're experts, unless you're going to be in the first inning of a baseball game that you're streaming and you're suddenly going to be down 7-0 to Patrick Klubnik, who only did the tutorial that morning. Then I think the whole notion of expert maybe gets called into question. But all that aside, these big sweeping changes coming to baseball, are they actually big sweeping changes? Like, are they being overstated?
So over the weekend, a few of my friends who do not watch any baseball whatsoever, nor are they interested in sports at all, had heard about the rule changes. I think they just like saw the title of various podcasts that was like big rule changes coming to baseball. And they were like, what is going on? Like, you know, are they adding a fifth base? Like what's happening? And what I told them was basically like, these are kind of PSYOP rule changes for the casual fan. All of it is designed to make the game more exciting and more like faster paced, because the big complaint for years is just like baseball's so boring, the games take so long, there's no action, there's so many strikeouts. But the rule changes that have been introduced are designed to fix those problems while not seeming like that big of a change. And as you mentioned, like the biggest one is the pitch clock, which means that in between each pitch, the pitcher will have 15 seconds to throw the ball, more or less. They tweak the pitch clock depending on whether there's people on base or not. There's like a little bit more time if people are on base. The pitchers are only allowed to throw over to first base, I believe, once per at-bat, or maybe twice per at-bat. They call it disengagements from the mound, where they sort of step off and try to
pick off. After that, a guy could just take a monster like lead?
After that, the pitcher can step off and throw, but no, after one disengagement, they have to deliver the ball home, I believe, or pick the person off. But if they try to pick them off and they are safe, it's like a balk, and they get the base anyway.
A balk. And Patrick and I just encountered that rule.
We got many balks called on us, and I have to admit, every time it happened, it was not. We were not intentionally playing with the rules. It was just we hit the button late, I think, and then all of a sudden it got counted.
Or I was late coming back from the pause screen, and I would like try to throw the ball, and it was like, nope, that was a balk.
You know, the show has gotten really, really in the weeds when you're able to do balks. It's like
you can, it's a flag, so you can turn them on and off. Like, so at least they understand that Because I think what exactly what was happening, we were playing, was is what Rob said, was that we were coming to the pitch.
We
late.
Were advised not to do it. Chat yes. was like, that's kind of a fussy thing to introduce. And it doesn't. And I will say it didn't play nicely with the way the show like cuts the dead time between pitches. Mm-hmm. And so like the balk seems to be a thing that is contextual. And if you just like cut to the part where it's like, okay, the pitcher's supposed to deliver the pitch now, real easy, just like fall backwards into a balk, whereas like it is not easy in life.
Yeah. The balk, this is earlier in the podcast than I expected to be talking about balks, but basically
welcome
for
to the
anyone
weeds.
Who
this
doesn't
is all
know,
we do
yeah.
here.
It's when the pitcher essentially like fucks up in a way that confuses the hitter or the runner. It's like if the pitcher falls off of the mound, that is considered a balk. But there's many number of ways that you can do it. And if this happens, the runner gets the next base for free. And the balk used to be like very rare. Like it would happen in high school because people wouldn't know what they're doing. And maybe once a year per team, you'd see a balk. But during spring training, there were like multiple balks per game. It's like the umpires were directed by Major League Baseball to be like giant hard asses about all of the new rule changes. And one of the side effects so far has been there's been a lot of balks. So it's
but
cool
that. Is that like maybe a natural result of changing like the momentum, the pace of the game, that you're going to have pitchers under the stress of the pitch clock potentially going through motions differently? Because as we know, I don't think there is a sport with more habitual weirdos than baseball, and suddenly throwing for a loop, like, and pitchers especially, right? Like probably no weirder like position that invites those sorts of characters and, or as MLB the Show calls them, quirks, like in one of the signifiers that has under stats for characters. But I guess it doesn't totally shock me that you'd have pitchers suddenly balking a lot just because you're throwing off something they've had ingrained in them in terms of timing since, I don't know, grade school.
Right. So that's one of the reasons that baseball got so slow, is because baseball is full of weirdos who have their rituals in between each pitch. And so you'd have both batters and pitchers who would have their thing. Like Nomar Garciaparra, who was a shortstop for the Red Sox for a very long time, was called like the human rain delay, because in between each pitch, he took his batting gloves and he like yep. undid the Velcro. He redid the Velcro. He stepped out, he stepped back in. And it's like the pitcher couldn't throw the pitch until he had done this. And so that's how you end up.
And it was between every pitch, like every single time.
Single time. And then you also have pitchers who will like catch the ball when the catcher throws it back to them, walk around the mound, do a little dance, like step off, play these mind games. And so the biggest rule change is this pitch clock. And in doing so, people have asked me like, what's going to be different about baseball? The biggest thing is kind of what you said, Rob, where they're just trying to cut out the dead time between pitches. And so far, like we're only a week into the season, but they had a pitch clock in the minor leagues last year, and they also had in spring training this year. It's like it's cutting off like 30 minutes from the average game. And that's 30 minutes of people like undoing their glove, putting their glove back on, spitting, like picking up the little chalk bag that's on the pitcher's mound to just, you know.
But what about the people standing in line at the ballpark for the long line to get a beer or a plant-based hot dog, is maybe I was doing on opening day at Wrigley Field with some friends. And
you missed half the thing.
I didn't pay for the tickets. And so I offered to go sacrifice myself in line once we got to our seats. And like, I'm going to get drinks for people. I'm going to get food for people. Like, text me what you want and I'll go stand in two long lines and someone will come out to grab the first. Cause you know, it's like, you know, drink minimum, or maximum rather. It's like, I'll go do all that because I'm just thankful to be here. Well, by the time I was working my way through like the second line, I happened to just glance up. I'd not been paying super close attention, cause in a baseball game, that's frankly part of the joy, is that I don't need to be paying attention to every little moment, especially when I'm there kind of basking in the stadium, like in-person experience. It was about to be like the fourth inning. Like, and I'd been gone for 40 minutes, which usually would be like it's, I was telling Rob this, we mentioned this at the end of our regular podcast yesterday while we were kind of teeing this one up, is that, you know, I think it's worse for the in-person experience. I think if you choose to go to a baseball game, broadly speaking, you are choosing to go to something that you are going to luxuriate in, like it's a beer-soaked hot tub. I expect to be here for a very long time, and I sort of only want to pay attention. It would be easier to watch this at home, which is true of a lot of sports, but like it was weird. I was there for 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Like, this is exactly my take, where it's like, it's better when for I the go to a home, baseball game,
better to watch, yeah. Worse in person.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you feel, Rob. I'm sure we will hear, but that's exactly how I feel. I wish there was a toggle. It's like, I'm at the game, do the slow version so that I can, you know, like talk to my friends, drink a bunch of beers, pee 45 times.
Like, so I have never made it to the start of a game at Dodger Stadium on time. Like getting up that fucking hill,
it's impossible.
To the game, like transit doesn't run out there. Traffic backs up all the way down the hill, like out onto all the approach streets. Most of the time, if I even want to make it up there by the third inning, I'm like bailing out of the cab or whatever at the foot of the hill and beginning like a hustle up the hill up there. And so when you say like, okay, the game's gonna be over in like 2.5 hours or less, well, to get to a Dodgers game, just getting out there is like a 2 hour like round trip investment. So it begins to change. Like if I'm gonna go through that hell, what I want is 3 hours or more of being in one of the most beautiful spots in LA and just like letting the day pass me by. I'm buying the mental break. I'm buying time in that space to just like be head empty, you know, and just sort of follow the game.
Head empty, beer full.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, when, during
especially because
they
stop selling beers after 7.5 innings.
Which it's like, that's when you order like a double or a triple beer.
Right. Where it's Jason, like, we, oh, had yeah. cancel, we had to cancel our last beer order. Like, we were in a terrible section where you could order them. There was a mobile order bit, but it was actually faster for me to go. So it's like, we'll order some from the mobile thing, and I'll also go stand in line, and then we'll double stack the beers and we'll be good to go past the seventh inning. Well, they got just a little bit backed up on the mobile ordering. The game moved so fast that we ended up either we canceled or they canceled the order because it just wasn't going to be delivered before the game was over.
I hate that.
Let me ask you this though. Was it the game length that like, it was like the game's too slow? I think the game was just too fucking boring because the problem is like 3.5 hour, even if the pace of play is slow, baseball is a game, and this is why it is probably the most successful like sport to translate into movies. It is a game just like built of dramatic moments and dramatic scenarios. Like the, you know, every like there's so many opportunities for character interactions effectively between the pitcher and the batter. And but the issue was because, and this is on the heels, all these changes are on the heels of another change they made last year, and I forget what the specifics are. They cut the bullpen size you're allowed to have. And so the issue, to me, I think, like, there were two things that kind of got swept together was the game is too boring, and it must be because the game is too long. And for me, it was never that. For me, it was every time something interesting was threatening to happen, it was, all right, well, he's going to the bullpen, a call-out pitcher for one strikeout. And then the next guy would come up, and there's still like two guys on base. And it's like another guy pulls out, comes out of the dugout, another strikeout, inning over, those two guys stranded. And it was hard to get them there. Like getting guys on base was hard. Getting to advanced bases was hard. And so baseball had this problem I don't think was a pace of play issue, unless pace of play was allowing pitchers to be better significantly. But for me, the big issue was like, balls did not get in play. You get that idea of the true outcomes. And baseball was becoming a true outcomes game. And it turns out that's not fun baseball to watch. And I think it was really highlighted. Jason, you and I think watched a little bit. You watched a lot. I watched a little bit toward the tail end of the World Baseball Classic. And there you had much more variance in terms of skill levels across a ton of positions. But one of them was pitchers. And one, it's more fun watching good hitters go up against pitchers who are like good but not great. Because now you can really see what a good pitcher can do and the damage they can inflict. But two, if there's just a lot more balls that are being like pitched to contact and just a lot more balls being put in play, you get more of those scenarios of like, you know, guy on first and third, like the tactics of baseball that had to me started to feel irrelevant in the past, like several seasons, where it was like, it was all feast or famine.
Yeah. So you are absolutely right. The biggest problem with baseball, the reason that it's been so boring, is this fundamental thing that happened, I would say maybe like 8 or 10 years ago, where, basically, pitchers started outpacing hitters to a ridiculous degree. It's like the average pitcher in Major League Baseball started getting way better than the average hitter in Major League Baseball. And the reason that this happened was basically like the analytics revolution, where not only did you have fielders standing all over the field where
the shift,
a computer simulation had determined that a player was most likely to hit the ball based on millions of, you know, they've run the simulation millions of times and they're like, okay, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is most likely to hit the ball to this specific part of the field, so we're going to play our fielders there, which resulted in many fewer base hits. It's like when the ball was hit, it was much more likely to be caught because the fielders were in the correct position based on the scientific analysis. But then on top of that, there's this performance institute called Driveline, which is basically like during the off season when you want to go upgrade yourself, like if you're a creative player and you want to add like 10 points to your control and stamina and power and all this sort of thing, you go to this this facility, which I believe is in Washington State, I'm pretty sure, where they just use like a million sensors. They film you as you pitch. They teach you new pitches. And they're like, you are not utilizing your body to the correct, like the scientifically perfect like way that you could be. And so they'll tweak your mechanics. They'll tweak how you throw. And people would come out of this, like major league players, like 32-year-old men who had been playing baseball their entire life, and they would be throwing 4 or 5 miles an hour faster, and they would be throwing, they would try to alter like the spin rate of the baseball to make it move more. And they would do this with the help of science, like more or less.
This is one of the big breakthroughs, right? The minute they isolated spin rate as a variable you could control using like high speed cameras and connecting that to your mechanics. Like, cause this was the other thing, right? It was like for a long time, I think we still do talk about like, he's got a, you know, 102-mile-hour fastball. That's like the decisive thing. But my understanding is like the science of pitching has put spin rate above just pure like arm strength and speed at this point. Like spin rate is like is better correlated to successful pitches than just sheer velocity.
Right. And there's new analytics called like Stuff Plus. There's all of these new analytics where it's like he's throwing 102 miles an hour, but it also has ride to it, which means that it's not a straight 102 mile an hour pitch. It's like, you know, moving like 18 inches horizontally or vertically. And at that point, it's like it is so hard to hit a baseball anyway. And you have these players who are going and improving, and the hitting has not caught up yet. Like Driveline does hitting analytics as well, but we have not been able to teach the average Major League Baseball player to hit this stuff regularly. And so you take that, and then you also take what you were saying, Rob, where you have, you know, the average Major League fastball is now something like 95, 96 miles an hour. Like 10 years ago, it was probably like 91, 92. People are throwing like nastier breaking pitches, and you have the Orioles don't have a particularly good bullpen. They have like four guys I can think of who throw like 98 to 100 miles an hour. And it's like, you would be lucky if there were two or three people in the entire league who were throwing 100 miles an hour, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so it's exactly what you were saying. It's like, oh, there's people on base. We're going to take our starting pitcher out. We're going to put in one of these nasty relievers. He's going to strike out two people in a row. Then we're going to replace him with someone else. And you're going to have these games that are like six bullpen pitchers just striking people out, and no one's going to get any hits. And the game is going to be 2-1.
Unless they get a home run.
It's going to take 4 hours.
It became either like a strike or a home run sort of league. And
yeah, exactly.
Like just people weren't going to. Yeah.
And home runs aren't an interesting, like, people like home runs, people love home run chases, but they're not actually that interesting an outcome, especially from the standpoint of like a single run out of context. It's like, whoa, that was a big home run. Game is now 3-1 and there's no, you know what I mean? Like, the game gets more interesting the minute you get like the tying run is on base. Oh, the winning run is now on base. Like, everything becomes more loaded once you get those scenarios going, but they had just dried up completely in the game. And this is like, I don't know. This is the one thing where, well, actually I'm curious, is the pitch clock going to help with, like, I was sort of spitballing with Kato on the main show the other day, but like my one theory I had certainly was that there is both a mental and physical strain that comes with throwing pitches, like that concept of command, of like being able to execute the pitch you wanted to throw and place it where you wanted to place it. And I would sort of assume that just having more time on the mound to sort of collect yourself, like get that, summon those, that energy would make it easier to deliver your good stuff again and again and again. Whereas like, if you're on a pitch clock, maybe you're sitting there and you're like, I don't have my good stuff right now. Like, I'll have to wait to the next batter, and now I need to start going off speed.
These are, you know, the best athletes in the world who decide to play baseball. There's other probably better athletes than the average baseball player in the NBA or NFL or many other sports. But these are, you know, the best conditioned people to play baseball. And even so... they are not able to throw max effort every single pitch with a pitch clock. Like, that is one of the biggest hopes, is that because these pitchers were taking so long in between pitches, their arm was basically able to recharge in between every pitch. It's like, I'm just going to take a walk. I'm going to catch my breath. I'm going to reset. When I'm ready, I'm going to throw it as hard as I fucking can. And you can't do that with the pitch clock anymore. It's like, the human arm will get tired throwing at max effort every 15 seconds over and over and over again for 100 pitches. And so you're absolutely right. I think that's one of the ways that, like, people aren't talking about it as much. Some people have definitely raised it, but I think it's like, that is going to have a huge impact on making these games more fun, because like we were talking about before, Rob, you know, a few weeks ago during the World Baseball Classic, the World Baseball Classic games were really fun because there were not that many strikeouts because the pitchers weren't that good. It's like, there were not as many MLB pitchers who participated in the World Baseball
Classic. And the MLB pitchers were under strict pitch limits. So, like, wave to that guy as he goes by, because, like, he's going to get a few at-bats and then it'll be on to whoever's behind him.
Right. So you have, like, a random plumber playing for... the Czech Republic throwing to like Mike Trout or something, and you end up having, you know, the fielders get a lot more involved. It's like, there's
in some ways it's a preview of like play. What they are trying to extract through the rules, even if taken into a more extreme end, is just right. Offense. At the end of the day, people want to watch more offense. It's more exciting. It makes a more balanced game. We see this in, you know, we talk a lot about the NFL here on the podcast, and like, that is where that league has also trended over the last 10 years, is with a lot of its rule changes that sometimes are under the guise of player safety. And there are sometimes that is true. It is actually trying to legislate out hits that are not considered dirty or extremely dangerous, and maybe stats point in that direction. But sometimes laundered into that or right alongside it is just, man, people like it when they throw the ball real deep and catch it. And like, how do we stack the rules in favor of more of that happening? People don't want to watch a 10-13 defensive grind. They want to watch a 30-32 like game in which every single pass could go for a touchdown. And it seems like baseball, you know, as the of any of the modern sports like that are kicking around, especially in a sort of like US centric viewpoint that we have here, like, is the one that seems to be being left behind the most in terms of generational shifts between audiences. And so absent changes like this, who knows how much it converts people, but it probably at least addresses some of the attrition. And especially as soccer becomes more popular, basketballs and baseball, you know, football are more popular than ever. It needs to do something to try and address the, like, at some point, baseball is the old-timey sport. you know, those people are going to die off. Like, what does baseball as a sport do as part of a generational transition?
Right. Rob, you mentioned something earlier that I just want to point out as well, where it's like we were becoming this three true outcomes thing, which means strikeout, walk, or home run. And some of the other rule changes have been designed to address that as well, like the bigger bases and you can't step off as often. This has already, like, anecdotally, like, the Orioles stole like 12 bases in like the first two games. Like, it was super fun to watch. They have these two players, Cedric Mullins and Jorge Mateo, who are just so fast. Like, they have, I think, 6 steals each through 4 games. But steals were like a lost art. Like, no one was stealing anymore. And the reason people weren't stealing anymore was because it was so damn hard to get on base that the risk of getting thrown out meant people didn't bunt anymore. People didn't steal anymore. This strategy that you were talking about that is so long associated with baseball was kind of going away because the base runners were so precious that it's like, we can't afford to lose that guy getting thrown out on a steal. And that's no longer the case because, one, they've made it easier to steal, and two, in theory, it's going to be easier to get on base, which I think will lead to more exciting games. And the games I've watched so far this year have been more exciting. We're only 4 games in, but a lot of high-scoring games, a lot of stolen bases, a lot of the announcers saying, that would have been an out last year because he hit it directly into the shift, but that the ball getting, you know, through to the outfield. And I think that's a good thing. I think so far the rule changes seem to be working as far as I can tell.
Well, it's, you know, it reminds me of baseball's kind of ground zero for the advanced stats revolution. And I think part of it is baseball, going back a long, long time, has always been one of the sports that you can statistically pin down really, really well compared to others, which have a lot of like every play in baseball is so self-contained. The results are so easy to quantify that baseball was like really ripe for that kind of broader and deeper quantification of everything that happens in a baseball game. Other sports are following in its wake, but a lot of them are just like harder to quantify in that way. But, you know, I think there was this period where people were really excited about how mathy, how quantifiable baseball could be. Like, I mean, this is sort of the appeal of Moneyball, right? Which is like, you know, literally a movie about all these dumbass old baseball guys who are like, I know what I'm looking for when I scout a player. And here you've got more of a like Wall Street mindset coming in and being like, no, I'm identifying value here. I don't give a shit, you know, how a guy plays. I just want to see what value he brings to the team. And that was really cool and exciting for people. Like, there was sort of an ascendancy of like nerdy front office people, like nerdy people becoming the face of the future of the sport. But it does seem like run the clock forward. And you have that concept of like games can be solved. And once a game is solved, it's kind of maybe not necessarily dead. Doesn't mean every game is like sort of deterministic, but it does mean you're not going to see any interesting clash of strategies because everyone is going to play the optimal strategy. And that is that. And it sort of seems in the last few years, baseball just converged on that, where it was like, defensive shifts made it really easy to narrow the probabilities for successful hits to just a fraction of what they've been. And then, yeah, like the emphasis on like high value positions like pitchers and operating them differently, getting rid of the idea of your starting pitcher being a star. This idea that like starting pitcher, it's like, oh, you're working on a no hitter. That's cute. Get out of the game. Because
yeah, you're tired. You know.
Exactly. And so I think the other, it feels like the broader trend that baseball needs to undertake, and maybe this is the start of it, is like you're introducing more vagaries that are going to be at least theoretically harder to stats your way around, right? Where it's like, if the pitchers are on a clock, if you're not allowed as many of them, if the substitutions are being made in what are like higher leverage situations, maybe it's less deterministic than it's been in the last few years. And maybe teams will start looking for other ways to play and other things to value as they build their team.
Broader question about this, though, isn't sort of the thing with, like, baseball owners don't even fucking like baseball. Like, when I look, like, and people who buy NFL teams tend to, they might be assholes, rich assholes, but they don't seem, they seem to like the sport, are invested in the sport. I find weird about, like, these changes seemingly being in favor of the game possibly being better, like, more appealing. But isn't, like, also part of, like, baseball's whole problem that, like, the owners are just squeezing them to such a degree that they're not even fans of the sport that they technically own. It's just an asset.
I mean, depends entirely on the owner. That's, I've been, the Angelos family has owned the Baltimore Orioles for a very long time. And Peter Angelos was this asbestos personal injury lawyer in Baltimore where,
oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. He made a shitload. He's actually, like, in his professional life, a really good person in that he, like, was, he's heavily pro-union. He's, like, represented lots of unions over the years. He sort of, like, fought against people, like, bad landlords for a long time. And yet, if you say Peter Angelos's name in Baltimore, it's like, fuck that guy. Like, he ran the Orioles into the ground. His son, John Angelos, even worse, just, like, you know, doesn't care about the team, doesn't care about baseball, doesn't want to spend on the team, only cares about making money, so on and so forth. And it's like, I know you have that in all sports where it's like, our owner sucks. I hate him. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't invest in the team. He meddles. You have this across all sports. But I do feel like in baseball, it's more of a money-making operation, I think, because there's not a salary cap.
Well, there's no salary floor either, right? And exactly. So, like, I can't name the teams off the top of my head, but I know that there are fans of certain teams where it just feels as though, like, they don't have to spend anything. They get enough from the broadcast rights, enough of generational fans show up to the stadium. They don't have to field a good team. And for all the problems that exist in the NFL, of which there are many, and we talk about them constantly, they have structured it towards mediocrity to the degree where even we root for, Rob and I root for a bad team, but what we actually root for is like a mediocre team because it's actually hard to win only 3 games the way the Bears did. They actually needed a lot of help to get there. And there was a lot of luck involved in doing that because, and this season was a big deal because the Bears had to spend, I think it was something like $130 million at a minimum because there is a salary floor agreed to that they, and so it's like, look, at a certain point, you're just going to pay enough okay players that you're going to win some games. And that seems broadly absent from baseball, which makes the cynicism, I think, which exists amongst all sorts of sports fans, but even more well-earned amongst baseball fans.
Yeah, you have this like inequality between teams and markets. That is, it's really funny to hear because we live in such an unequal society where income inequality is maybe one of the biggest problems that we have. And yet you have like these billionaires being like, well, I couldn't possibly afford to, you know, put a good team on the field. And so you have teams like the Orioles who spent, I think, $30 million last year on their payroll.
What?
Competing in the same league as the Mets, the Yankees, the Dodgers, same broader league that Mets and Dodgers are in the National League, the Orioles in the American League, but they're spending $250, $300 million a year. The Orioles are spending spent $30 million last year. There are players, single players who make more than the entire team. And it's like the Orioles are spending like $60 million this year. And it's like, oh, we're barely able to make our ends meet. And it's like these people are billionaires
fits too. Cause it's like, we know, like, cause that means that when we send our stars to tour through through Baltimore, you're going to get a lot of people showing up to that game so they can watch actual good players. Like, you know, the Angels are coming through and like people are going to come out and they're going to see like Otani and Trout like play. That's what they're going to come see. But it's like the Angels are spending that money to have those players. And meanwhile, the Orioles are like, you know, come watch our bad news Bears level team play against an actual like group of stars. And like I could see that being a weird team owner dynamic if there's kind of a sensation of like you're kind of free riding on the strength of the game as a whole, but also the strength of other people's rosters that we are forced to bring through town.
Well, there's also enhanced like revenue sharing between teams as well. And so there's some big pool of money that, you know, the profits from the Yankees and the Dodgers, et cetera, like go to the Orioles, even if they don't spend shit, they are making money that, you know, if they're unable to run a profitable team, which they are, they make a ton of money because of what you mentioned, Patrick, the sort of like TV rights and just the ancillary income of people coming to the game to even to watch a shitty team. It's like they're also then getting paid by the Yankees, the Angels, these teams that make a ton of money from a bigger profit revenue sharing pool that comes from sort of the profits across the entire industry. But all that said, even if a lot of these teams that don't spend a lot of money are able to put together really good teams because they've taken advantage in this money ball type way of the sort of inequality that of like baseball players have, teams have rights to baseball players their first 6 years, regardless. And so the Orioles right now are spending almost nothing, but they're expected to maybe be a playoff team because, or at least in the hunt, because they have, you know, first, second, third draft picks for years and years of tanking. And they're paying those players like the MLB minimum, even though they're really good. And then the second that they hit free agency, they're going to go sign, you know, $200-400 million contracts with the Dodgers, the Mets, the Cubs, teams that are willing to spend. And the Orioles will have, you know, a new crop of young players that they have drafted and developed. And it's one of those things
isn't that the ideal? Because I forget the quote. This quote actually is attributed to Jerry Reinsdorf. Reinsdorf? What is that, Rob? The Bulls, White Sox.
Reinsfeld? Reinsdorf?
Who's Reinsdorf?
Reinsdorf? Yeah. This is a bit apocryphal, but it is well within. There's been lots of complaints about the Bulls and White Sox owner being notoriously cheap over the years. And there was a quote that went around that I'm going to further mangle. But essentially, it's like, you don't actually want to win. You want to be in the hunt. And there's a way of looking at exactly what you're talking about, which is that, well, can we maximize statistical analysis and analytics of baseball to make a lot of money from the fans, pay the players very little, and just constantly have this perpetual question of hope on every season? Like, there'll never be a year that we push in and like take on actual risk and maybe hand out a bad contract and like push for the World Series in the way that most sports teams talk about, like windows, right? Like, hey, we're hedging a bunch of risk that we're going to pay for in the years after, but maybe we win a World Series or a Stanley Cup or a Super Bowl. And here it sounds like there's a potential scenario where it's like, look, that team's pretty all right this year. Like, never going to win it, never going to get over the hump, but like the team gets to spend no money, make a lot of money, and the fans get to be like, that year was all right.
This was a major, major problem in baseball, and it still is, but the most recent collective bargaining agreement sort of punishes teams for tanking a little bit more and incentivizes going for it, not in ways worth discussing right now.
Yeah.
But basically, like the San Diego Padres, for example, like San Diego is not the biggest market team, but over the last couple of years, like they have really gone for it. They traded for Juan Soto, who's one of the best players. They signed Xander Bogaerts, who's a very good player from former Red Sox. They have Manny Machado. Like they have made these massive, massive signings and these massive trades where they've mortgaged their future, like trading all of these prospects for established stars, which is nominally what you want, right? Like you want teams that are going for it. But when the Padres did that, everyone was like, what are they doing? Why are they trying to win a World Series? Like, don't they realize they're getting rid of some of their young assets, that these young players that might make them kind of good a few years from now? And it's like, that's how teams were managed for a long time, where it's like, you want to keep that window really long so that you can field a really like okay team at a cheap price and not be accused of tanking, but also not ever really go for it. And it, over the last couple of years, like this year and last year, we've seen a bit of a change. We've seen the Cubs are seemingly trying to go for it, which we can talk about. Like they've made some big signings. The Mariners really pushing in, trading a lot of prospects, the Padres as well. And for years, that didn't happen. There was like the Dodgers and the Yankees were going for it every year. Besides that, you had a bunch of teams that were like, well, maybe if we kind of like if all our prospects graduated at the same time and we get hot in the postseason, maybe we can win. But you didn't have the teams going from like 85th percentile to like, we are pushing all our chips in. And if we lose, like we lose, but we're at least going for it, which is, I think that's another reason people stop caring, because you had all these teams that were like, well, we're trying to be a 500 team this year. We're not trying to do anything more than that. Like, and you have that for like 10 years in a row. It's like people stop caring.
Yeah. 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 Before we have you depart, I do want to have some of our listeners chime in with some questions. You can write into gamingadvice.com with the topic sports, or if you keep a lookout on Twitter, we usually have a Google form going around that you can submit some. Sam from Iowa asks, the designated hitter rule, what a bunch of bullshit, right?
I think it's bullshit.
Can you explain what it is if you are not baseball inclined?
The designated hitter is something that the American League has had for a very long time. Basically, there's two leagues in baseball, and half of the teams had the pitcher hit, and half of the teams had a designated hitter, meaning the pitcher did not hit, and there was a player who didn't play the field. He just
Which is
hit.
Wild that there are even different rules. I actually think that's kind of cool, but like it is weird, and has always struck me as weird, that there are actual, maybe not foundational, but at least interesting wrinkles between the two different sets of teams.
Yeah. And then like 2 years ago, they got rid of pitchers hitting at all, and now there's designated hitter across the entire sport.
They do it right as Shohei Ohtani would have given you a huge advantage for, like, that guy can be on the mound and also be an elite hitter. And right as we're about to have the most interesting player, like, really coming in his own in the major leagues, they're like, designated hitter across the
and board. Hit free agency, right? Like to mm-hmm. command a salary and contract unlike we may have potentially have not seen like in ages. Like I agree, I am only a passing baseball fan, but I think if you suck at hitting, I'm sorry, I also sucked at hitting when I played baseball in third grade. You know what I had to do? Get up there and get beamed by the ball and like take my
and
lumps.
Also I like the idea that if you want like a monster hitter out there, if he can't field, you're going to have to hide him somewhere and hope it doesn't like break his way. I like the idea of, all right, well, we're coming up. It's the eighth inning and we are going to put this Hulkster out there in center field and have the other guys sort of come like try to cover. And that's how we're going to stash him out there.
Pitchers hitting is also the only thing in professional sports that I can think of outside of like a fake punt where someone who is really bad at something is made to do it against like it at the yes. professional stage, because it's like the average pitcher is really, really shitty at hitting. But, you know, once every 5 days for 3 or 4 at bats, like you're going to watch this pitcher like flail about like an idiot trying to hit the ball, and then every once in a while they run into one and it makes like the pitcher home run, the pitcher double or whatever, so much more exciting. In the same way that like really like watching a punter throw is always so fun in my opinion, and it's like doesn't work out that often, but when it does it's special, and they did get rid of that. So I'm with you, I think DH is bullshit.
Another question, anonymous, how deep is the podcast into an advanced analytics in baseball? As someone who has gotten into them over the last few years, mostly to stay competitive in fantasy baseball, I can't help but look at a player and only see ISO, spin rate, exit velocity, WRC+, etc. I guess, Jason, do you play fantasy? Does that influence how you look at the game when you start having analytics brain while watching?
So I don't play fantasy anymore. I was thinking about trying to get into Out of the Park Baseball, which is a baseball sim that is legendary.
I can forward you a code, Jason, then you can chime in and let us know, because neither of us are going to play.
Yeah, I'll take it.
I have
it.
Like the last 8 editions of Out of the Park, and I'm always like, open it. Whoop. Nope.
Like a million. Do you want to play a game that's only spreadsheets?
Yeah. It's like,
do we have a game for you. I don't pay that close attention to advanced statistics outside of the fact that I'm an obsessive Orioles fan, meaning I read all the forums. Like there's this website called Orioles Hangout that I go to every day and have been to every day for like 20 years.
That
and
rules.
It's run by a complete lunatic. Like After Baltimore had to cancel one of its games after the Freddie Gray protests, because of a police killing, and like the Orioles did something where they're like, we stand in solidarity with the people of Baltimore, blah, blah, blah. He like shut. I think it was this or some other terrible tragedy like this, where the Orioles did like a very basic, like, we're going to wear a band on our jersey. He shut down the website because he was like, I don't want politics in my baseball. He shut down the website for like a week or something and then like brought it back on. So it's a like lunatic forum where there's a million rules. If anyone who like upsets the forum,
I gotta know, how much are you just a lurker there and how much?
Oh, I don't post. Like, you know, I was banned. Okay. I was banned posting like in high school. In high school, yes. For like some
innocuous
thing.
You've never just gotten an alt account? Is it that much harder to get a new
Smith? I tried to log into my old account like a year ago, and it's like, you're still banned. I've been banned since like 2003 or something.
But does it have the like the classic foreign politics? There's people that he likes and just can say whatever shit they want. Mm-hmm. And like everyone else.
There's no politics allowed on this forum, like unless you want to like slyly infer that like the liberal media is unfair and biased, in which case it's completely fine. That's not a political statement.
What happens when there are union disputes? Like the miners just signed that new contract,
it's
right?
Which so I know funny. It's so funny because they try to separate. It's like the stick to sports taken to its extreme, where there'll be like massive, massive issues in baseball, like work stoppages and things like that, and it's like you can't say that the owners are greedy and you can't say that the players are greedy. You can only discuss like the facts of what is occurring. It's very bizarre, and it weirdly sort of works because it's one of those sites where there's like 100 posters who have been there forever and they just talk to each other and I just read. I haven't made a post since high school. I can't log in. I could make an alt, but I haven't bothered to. I don't want to have an account. I just read it. It's not that, like, there's not that many posts, so it's not that hard to keep up with. In any case, that's a very, very long answer to. I pay attention to the advanced statistics of like Orioles and their prospects to be like, oh yeah, can't believe we signed this idiot with like a terrible isolated power rating, you know, or who stuff plus is under the median for the average, you know. Ooh, major league real.
I'm just hearing we need to get Jason. Do you have something you can play MLB the Show? We got to get Jason.
I have PS5. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to let's friend up. Let's play some games together. I got to practice. I got fucking rinsed by Patrick. Patrick fucking Klepek rinsed me on stream playing his. Oh, yeah. Let me tell you this bullshit.
The Cubs versus Cubs game. Fuck this. I love it.
Okay. So we're playing by different rules. And this isn't Patrick's fault. Like the game defaults to like, here's your standard, like starter mode. Batting is really hard. We're just going to have you like try to click the swing button when the timing feels right. I'm playing the like mode where I'm going to try to learn how to hit as I play this game. And I'm like, in other versions of the show, I've gotten decent at this. I'm struggling mightily with this one. Maybe it's just I'm rusty, but so first inning, I start pitching. And Patrick is just like, see ball, hit button, ball in play. And two things happen. One is that I spend a lot of time batting and I spend a lot of time pitching. I don't do much fielding. And also Patrick kept hitting into seams. And so it was things where it was like you'd have two guys converging on the ball and it auto defaulted to me controlling, like in one case, who I thought was the wrong one. Like, it had me running in as the center fielder to make the play, and the left fielder had it. So I backed off. The AI guy backed off, probably because the human player has priority, and it's just like, plunk, double. Like, just, so first inning this is happening, and this is just like every single pitch, like Patrick's just like tattooing it for like doubles. And my pitcher goes on tilt, like confidence starts to go down. Like the worse things are happening, the worse your pitcher gets. So it just turned into carnage. Like, what was it? Five runs in the first inning?
No, five or six.
You finished with seven, but I think you picked up a couple more.
I might have. Yeah. Two home runs there in that inning. Yeah. It was just beautiful.
I have normal at bats. I'm having trouble putting it in play. But even when I went to the timing mode, I was still like, I was getting more hits and they were going straight into people's
glass. Yeah.
And
this is the perennial problem with baseball video games, I think, is the control one where it's like, oh, I'm controlling the wrong player here. I want the center fielder to catch this ball, but it gave me the left fielder, and the AI can't run as fast for some reason. I haven't played in a few years, but that was always my problem, and I would get so frustrated.
It just feels like you have to be really quick at reading, like, who are you controlling? You can hit L2 to, like, switch players, but you have to be really quick to identify, like, where am I in this play? Am I the right player in this play? And then what am I going to do the minute I catch the ball? And like, I just didn't have the rhythm for that. To be fair, like Patrick didn't either, but I wasn't putting enough balls in play that really came up that much. So it was just absolute carnage, but it was one of those things where it was like that first inning was such a disaster and things like got tighter after that.
Rob's confidence.
And then like Patrick has a whimsy to him when things are going well. And I'm like starting to be like, oh my God, I'm going down in flames. And so Patrick goes into, I need to bring even more energy to the stream. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is not the energy I need you to bring to this fucking game, Patrick. And Patrick starts singing like Cubs fight songs as I'm just getting massacred here. And I'm just like, okay, let's just get, it was brutal. But I do think like there's 3-player co-op. I think we could all be out there like playing some ball together.
I'm down. I'm down. Yeah.
And you can help us understand franchise mode. Because we got in there and the sheer number of decisions that you have to make in franchise mode.
Are you supposed to fire like your first base coach because your players keep getting their arms fractured? That's what we decided. We just got his ass out of there. Like,
yeah, dude. He's not handing those players the running glove with the long, you know, the long... They have special gloves for sliding now, and that first base coach probably wasn't giving your players the protective gloves.
Yeah, we just had to get his ass out of there.
Thank you.
David Ross, you too. Like, just, might be a real nice guy, but you're not coming for
us. No, vibes aren't enough on this team, which maybe brings us to our last question before we let you go. We've managed to incredible self-restraint, also because we barely understand the rosters of these teams, although I know a little bit more than Rob does on this front. Do you have any sense of the 2023 Chicago Cubs, what is anything at all to tell us about what you think they may or may not be or do this season?
Yeah, the Cubs were bad for a few years after winning the World Series. They sort of like went all in. They won the World Series. Then they went into
possibility, a little dynasty there, and just you could even tell
that World Series roster, it was teetering. Like it never produced enough offensively. It never came close to producing enough offensively.
Yeah. And so then, like many other baseball teams, they sort of were like, well, we're giving up for the next 3-4 years and we're kind of tanking. And then this year, it looks like they're trying to get back to respectability. And I think I don't like the NL Central that much. Like, I think the Brewers are overrated. They have very good pitching, but
it's hailing right now. Sorry. I heard a lot of loud noises and was wondering what that was. It's giant things of hail. Continue. Sorry.
It's like, all good. I think that like one injury to the Brewers, and I think the Cardinals are overrated. And it's like, I can see the Cubs sneaking into the playoffs this year. It's like they signed Dansby Swanson, who's a really, really good shortstop.
Yep.
Very exciting player. I think that, Northsiders are really going to like him for years to come. Cody Bellinger, won an NL MVP like 3 or 4 years ago.
They're betting like a 1-year deal on him that like it's a bounce back and you'll get a big contract somewhere else. It won't be here, but you can have your bounce back year here.
He's been bouncing back for like 3 years now.
Yeah,
but if this is the year he bounces back,
someone can fix him.
You know, like one of the like fan favorites last year was Sei Suzuki, who had a really good like first third of the season before pitchers seemed to figure out how to throw to him. And then he had a pretty rough go of it at the end. He had what they were calling an oblique injury in spring training, but it's supposed to be back in the next couple of weeks. But he was like one of the promising like young players that hopefully is a little bit better this year.
Yeah. So I think it's like they're clearly the third best team in the division. They're way better than the Reds and the Pirates. I think that they are underrated by a lot of people. And I think that not a lot has to go right. It's like if Bellinger is at all what he used to be, which is a huge if because he's been kind of bad for a while. And if you get some pitching, I think that, you know, you're going to be in the hunt. Oh, the other big one is Trey Mancini is like, he's not a great player, but he played for the Orioles for a long time. And he's an inspirational story. He had colon cancer 2 years ago and missed the entire 2020 season. And it was like stage 4, stage 3, like really bad. He came back and played pretty well for the Orioles, got traded to the Astros and won World Series last year. And he's someone to root for, if nothing else. He's a good guy from all I can tell, all the articles I've read. Inspirational story there. Hey, so
sometimes when
I think
goes,
he'll be good.
If the team goes poorly, that's what you start grasping onto. Look at this inspirational story that can make me feel good when I've got this on in the afternoon. Well, we're going to head towards a break, let you go, Jason, go do more important things than shoot the shit about this. But we appreciate having you on. Is there anything happening over at Motherboard that you want to point people towards? Stories, streams, podcasts?
Oh, yeah. You should definitely check out our AI coverage. I mean, Chloe Zhang is our AI reporter and is just sort of doing an incredible job of explaining what's going on with ChatGPT, what Silicon Valley is up to with this stuff. And I think that people are starting to get sick of AI this, AI that, but it really is changing very fast. And it's one of those things that
it's not the new crypto. I think a lot of people looked at this as like, gee, it seems like a lot of the people that were very into crypto are now very into AI. Is this just like some bullshit that I can ignore? And it seems to suggest, or at least you're suggesting, that is not the case.
I don't think you can ignore it. I was going to say it's something that I think is both way overhyped, but also underhyped, in that it's like, it is going to change many things. I do not think that we're going to die from an AI apocalypse anytime soon. At the same time, it's like the projects that are happening are having real world implications, whereas like crypto was something that was like just full of profiteering and losers. Whereas AI is full of that too, but then there's also like real scientists doing like really batshit things with AI. And I think that Chloe's really good at cutting through the nonsense with this and sort of both pouring cold water on the hype, but also being like, hey, this is like the stuff that you should actually pay attention to. So I would check out her coverage. Really good.
Awesome. Well, Jason, thanks for joining us. And we'll have to, as the season goes on, we'll have to have you back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is my first ever sports pod.
Hell yeah. Okay. Once you got, you know.
It'll be your last. It's a long baseball season.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. All right, so Rob, I asked a certain question at the top about the Cubs because we were doing baseball stuff, but the Bulls. Okay, I have a question. What the fuck, man?
Yeah. What about them? They're frisky.
Was that the comeback game? Largest comeback of the year?
Yeah, they were down. They were down like 20 some points.
I turned that game off.
And they weren't looking good in that first half. And they started to like, they put the clamps on them in the third quarter. And then they just got the Grizzlies to melt down. It was incredible. Like there was a run of, I want to say like four Grizzlies possessions that ended in embarrassing turnovers. Like Bulls just ripping passes out of the air, tipping them and then like getting them in play and pass. Like it was mortifying. The Grizzlies could not like hold on to the ball. And every time they took it down into their offensive end, immediately the Bulls would get a breakaway and they folded. They like at the end of that run, I think they pulled their starters. It was done at that point. Like, the Bulls had already sort of been like getting control of that game. But after that, it was like NBA Jam, like the defensive version of NBA Jam, where like, you know, all the Bulls just fire pouring off them. And the Grizzlies just collapsed. It was beautiful.
As it stands, according to NBC Sports Chicago, from an article, I was trying to figure out where do things stand with the Bulls in terms of the postseason. So the NBA adopted a couple of years ago something called the play-in tournament, which is kind of the equivalent to a wild card. Did that start with the bubble year, or was that before the bubble
year? I remember the bubble year. They tweaked a bunch of things to basically make some interesting teams more viable.
Well, to their credit, like the season didn't get to finish, right? And so the notion was, do you just accept the standings as they were when the season shut down in mid-March, or do you come up with an alternative? So maybe the plan, I can look this up possibly, but regardless, the plan is relatively recent in the history of the NBA. Prior to that,
it is, and somewhat controversial.
And there were not wild card spots. It was either in or you're out, and the reason I think defensively people don't like, one game play-ins is because it can benefit statistical outliers or off games. And part of the reason that people like basketball, baseball especially, is the notion that like you have to prove that you are good over long stretches of time, as opposed to having fluke performances allow you to, you know, advance.
But I think what's smart about it is that, you know, if you start from the assumption that first of all, at the end of a regular season, your seventh and eighth seeds, your seventh and eighth place teams are probably not very viable teams regardless.
Yeah.
But two, you do have the odds there of like, if the difference between like 7, 8, 9, and 10 can be pretty marginal, maybe you're going to get a more interesting playoffs if like you have those guys go into the Thunderdome and see who emerges. Because I do think I think the Bulls are a really good example of this right now. The Bulls were having a lost season. They were in really bad shape a few weeks, a month or so ago. Basically, when I started watching them, they were like close to being out of it entirely.
There was tank talk. Is this a moment where
they had just decided not to, and up and down, like people were saying they had fucked up their trade deadline decisions.
Well, they did nothing. They did absolutely nothing at the trade deadline to either, perhaps irresponsibly gone all in and tried to acquire talent that would have bolstered the team, especially defensively, especially from a three-point shooting standpoint. They are a terrible three-point shooting team over the course of this season. And just the construction of the roster just does not allow them to really sink that many of those. And they did nothing. And that also meant they didn't trade away their most valuable assets. You have Vucevic is coming up as a free agent. He is most likely going to be a re-sign, but he is most valuable as a chip to get assets when he is about to become a free agent.
DeMar DeRozan, similar situation where it's like player has value now, but is aging.
Yes.
They did make some moves. They brought in Patrick Beverley.
I mean, look, at this point, so Patrick Beverley is an interesting player. You know, he's a veteran presence. He was, what do they call it? Like when that period when they acquired him, and they also were, the Bulls were also rumored to be getting Russell Westbrook. They're not undrafted free agents, but it's not free. There's like a specific phrasing that I'm not remembering. Mm. Anyway, sort of regardless, like the Bulls acquired Patrick Beverley, who is from Chicago, I believe. And so it was kind of like a hometown reunion. He really wanted to come play for the Bulls. And you know, I don't know where the stats fall on his contributions, but he is a large presence. He is a large personality.
He's a huge personality. And this is the thing. Like, I got into the Bulls like at the kind of the perfect time, because they were just starting to get a load of the Patrick Beverly experience. And I had really warmed up to him in the last few years because he's a tryhard player. He's a little bit edgy, but he is one of those guys where it's like the dude shows up, right? He's like a less talented Jimmy Butler in some ways, where it is like a similar sort of grit and grind style of player, but like with fewer gifts. But what he makes up for is he is one of those like locker room guys who also is going to sort of has the ability to call guys out and like kind of tutor other players in what they should be doing and how they should be approaching the game. And he got that team. Like it felt to me like you could see him and Alex Caruso, almost boot camping that team. Once Beverly was there, you had him calling people out for bad defense, like taking people aside in the middle of a game and being like, here's how you fucked that last possession up.
It was and, like a coach-like atmosphere. I mean, like this article from CBS when the Bulls signed him. The front office is hopeful that Beverly can bring some toughness to the team as they try to get back in the playoff picture. Now 34 years old, Beverly is no longer an all-defensive caliber player, but he works hard and is still capable of pestering opposing guards. His abilities on that side of the ball should help strengthen a Bulls team that has surprisingly been one of the best defenses in the league. Exiting the All-Star break, the Bulls are 7th in the league with 112 defensive rating. But even if Beverly can give the Bulls a spark with his energy, it's hard to imagine that'll make enough difference on a team that's spiraling out of control. They lost their last 6 games prior to the All-Star break and are now in 11th place in the Eastern Conference at 26-33, which puts them 2 games behind the 10th place Toronto Raptors. And that was on February 20th around the trade deadline.
And then look up their record since the All-Star break.
They are 38-40.
That's their season record.
Sorry. Well,
yeah, to figure out where I can pull that. But it really marked a sea change for how that team was playing. And so I think you do like.
And they've had personality clashes. DeRozan and LaVine have not been on the same page in terms of how much you on the bar of style and personality and use by coaching. I don't know. I'm not in those locker rooms. All you can say is that, boy, it seems like you have two players who are just competing to be sort of like the alpha of the team as opposed to playing off of one.
And that is really eased up. Like, and this is the way, like, I would say that in a weird way, that may have been settled in Levine's player in his favor. Certainly watching it in these past few weeks, I have seen LaVine just become the, like, he is the, I'm going to go get a bucket guy. He is the, like, if he touches the ball and the defense is not rock solid, he is going to just like try to charge through it. And also he has a great, pull up and, he's got like a great pull up and fade away like 2-point shot so that if he's getting like blocked off from reaching the basket, he will just like disengage from the defense and fall away from them and take a 2. And more often than not, that shot is good too. And so he's become that guy where it's like, you know, if there's any sort of defensive weakness, he will go exploit it. And DeRozan seems to have fit, is more comfortable letting him play that role. But like going back to the play-in tournament, like watching the Bulls, I think they're really, you know, kind of, this is where the play-in tournament gets a little more interesting, because I do think when you're looking down at that tier of the Eastern Conference, the Bulls maybe have a bit more wind at their back than a lot of the teams that are around them. And so to an extent, like, do you at least want to give them the chance to knock off a team that is kind of, you know, a little closer to like flailing the way the Hawks are, right? Or, back when this all unfolded, the Pacers were sort of neck and neck with the Bulls. They could have easily been headed to the play-in tournament. They've since sort of collapsed. But I think this is where the tournament gets interesting, is that the Bulls have gone from being kind of a hopeless team to being a pretty interesting one, and at times quite a good-looking one. A lot of players have made a surprising leap in the past few weeks. Like Kobe White has gone from he's been, I want to say, like, even when I checked them out last year, he was sort of emerging as like, that's an interesting player. He is starting to become that guy who more, you make a better case for him as a starter, but also is just one of those guys we're coming off the bench. He turns the bench into
you
just
think an of onslaught. Three. You know, I mean, like that's a lot of like the highlight shots you're seeing from him is him and Patrick Williams are two players that if this team was going to do anything this year, especially with Lonzo Ball, essentially probably not having a career in basketball anymore. Like even if you're being
barring miraculous surgery
at this point, you're hoping he has a comfortable life as opposed to returning to the basketball court.
Right. Cause he's, he sounds like he has like a really horrible degenerative, like situation.
He is about, he underwent a surgery, I believe related to cartilage that, only one player has returned to playing afterwards. And I don't even think it was in the NBA. And also the Bulls, there was a report that they are no longer even privy to his private medical status. It's just occasionally his team lets them in. And it's like all those are, it's, there is sort of like, there, there's like an injury emergency lever that the team can pull with the league based on, like there's stuff they can do where it's not, the contract will not be an albatross next season. But anyway, you needed these other players to fill in this enormous gap that has existed on the team since Lonzo went out with an injury more than a year ago. And these players, while I don't think this is sort of a team that is going to make it to the finals, like they are at least in the scenario, you know, Dr. Strange waving his hands around and the, all the scenarios that can happen. Well, winning two games in the first round, I don't think is out of the realm of possibility in a way that I would have completely dismissed it before. I think it depends on the team. I think they pull the Bucks or the Celtics, then I think you're going to be, well, maybe the Celtics. The Celtics, you might have an easier
the
time.
The Celtics are like the team you could easily see just like dropping it against the Bulls. Like, you know, we'll see. Hopefully they're a different team mentally than they were last year. Like I was gutted to watch them unravel against the Warriors. Like it was so clear, like on their day, they were so clearly a better team, like just massively outgunned the Warriors. And then they just wouldn't show up some nights. But so like the Bulls have become a really interesting team. I've really had a lot of fun watching. Now, part of it is just I love watching NBC Sports Chicago. I love that broadcast. And
well, we had that whole conversation. Ticks. Someone asked about do commentators make a difference in watching something or how does it influence that? And I pointed out, I did not put a name to it at the time, but since then, obviously, Rob, you have Stacey King, like one of the two NBC Sports Chicago announcers that announces every Bulls game that you're watching from the local broadcast is just an absolute character, a delight. And as someone that even when I've watched the team play poorly, I still just, it's not even about an analysis. They're just entertaining. Like they can be a very, very insightful and help me understand the game, but they're just fun to listen to watching a team I love, even if they're doing that part poorly. And you have like entered into that space when, even if they're not always playing well, frequently they're playing at least like middling or frustratingly, but you have an entertaining product in front of you. And sometimes that is enough.
Yeah. And like, it's, and also like, it's just such a, it's such a weird energy compared to a lot of the national broadcasts. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's a little bit more like if inside the NBA were calling the game rather than just doing the desk. But yeah, it's been fun getting into them. It's been fun watching them like go on this little run and sort of like I would say to me, it's felt like in a lot of cases, I've been watching playoff basketball now for a few weeks, and that's a cool place to be, right?
Because like stakes are high. Every game means they could be in or out of it. Like they're have been on a knife's edge for the better part of 6 to 8 weeks.
Right. And I think it makes her interesting. Like here's the weird thing. They demolish both the Nuggets and the Grizzlies in their encounters with them. Like this has been the wrap on this year's Bulls. I guess last year's the issue was they compiled a really good record, but mostly like by beating up on trash teams.
Yes.
And then everyone sort of knew that the minute the field narrowed as it does in the playoffs to pretty good teams, the Bulls were going to be in trouble. As it happened, you know, the Bucks, it was just a brick wall. That was never going to go any other way. This year, the Bulls have actually been better against good teams, and the rap on them is they just kind of like don't show up or don't get it in a gear against your more marginal teams where like they just either they haven't scouted or they're just so astonished to find themselves in a shootout against a bad team that they get back footed. I've seen it happen. But like both the Grizzlies and the Nuggets, the Bulls like shut them down so effectively that in both cases, those games were over, you know, early in the fourth, where you had the team, you had both those teams just shut everyone down because
they're blowouts. They,
yeah, and those are teams that are like, okay, we're playing, like we're in the playoffs. Now it is, there's no point in keeping guys in this fight against the Bulls. So we're just gonna give up. But like against, you know, in some of these teams, some of these games against like teams that are a little more marginal, it does just go all the way to the end. Like their, you know, their series against the Sixers was fascinating because like the Sixers have stuff to play for. It is they're fighting for a better seed. And so the Sixers like were not going to give up those games easily. And so those turned into the first one turned to real bruising games. The second one, I think, was good for the Bulls to get blown out that way, mm-hmm. because I think like I think in this run, it's good to have your reality check too, of if you are going to have any kind of like fun little postseason, if getting through the play-in is going to be meaningful at all, here's what you need to prepare for. It's Joel Embiid is going to decide, I'm going to fuck these guys up tonight.
Yeah.
And you need to be prepared to meet that. Like, you need to answer that bell.
And we'll see. We could actually have an answer on the play-in tournament by the time you listen to this podcast. According to this NBC Sports Chicago article, they have to win one game ahead of the remaining games on their schedule against the Hawks, the Bucks, the Mavericks, or the Pistons. That's the order in which they play these teams. They play the Hawks tonight as we record this. And crucially, Trae Young, their star player, is out with a non-COVID related illness. And so that becomes, the Hawks have not exactly, you know, lit the world on fire this year, but they are a like young and spunky team that can play well. And so the Bulls have an opportunity to, I don't think they can graduate outside of the play-in tournament. I don't know if that's completely
because they would have to unseat the Nets, and that there's just not enough games left. I think it's a situation where like even if the Nets imploded with their remaining games,
I think probably I think probably what actually is happening from here is like if they can win tonight, then what you do for the remaining games is like, do we want to win? Like it's a seeding battle. It's like, who do we want to play? Is it worth playing tonight? Because that alters who we play in the tournament. You know, that may be where they're at with the final games of the season. But
well, and if they can claw their way forward into eighth place, which is doable, I think, looking at the standings right now, they are in a win and in situation, right? The first game of the play-in tournament between the two teams who sort of have the rightful place in the playoffs, the 7th, 8th place teams, the winner of that just goes straight in to the playoffs at the number 7 seed. So the Bulls do have something to play for here, which is that, you know, if they sort of claw their way forward into 8th place, which is doable, if they can get one game off the Heat, which they can absolutely do, then they're in the postseason.
Yeah, as it stands, they would be playing the Raptors if the play-in tournament was to be held tomorrow with the current standings. So we'll see. It makes every game, it's going to make every game exciting. I'll tell you that much. And so I am, if they make it into that, sports will return to chime in on where the Bulls go from here. We got a couple other questions we'll get to here. This one that was a follow-up from our last podcast where we talked a little bit about college basketball. Hey, Way Sports, I was listening to the most recent sports episode, and as a college basketball enjoyer, I need you both to know that Bob's opinion on NCAA basketball is too controlled by the coaches is completely correct, but I will argue that it is part of the sell for many people. In my opinion, you can't watch college basketball the same way you watch the NBA. As Rob and Bob said, the NCAA is incapable of providing the level of star power or, quote, main character athleticism that the NBA can. You'll never have a LeBron in college ball, and the players graduate too soon to really build up any sort of acclaim or talent that stretches farther than their division. If college players don't provide the level of personality or skill you would normally get in the NBA, what does that leave us with? Coaches. Look at the conversation around basketball coaches in college. People love or hate them more than any player, and the success of a team is largely credited to coaching. When my alma mater, Iowa State, had a run of great seasons a few years ago, no one really attributed that to player talent, although we did have a strong team. The conversation was all about how Fred Hoiberg, who was a Bulls coach, right? That nobody liked, right? Fred Hoiberg. Bulls. Bulls coach, right? Yes. Yes. Fred was, yes, this, okay. No, actually, Hoiberg was from the Bulls 2015 to 2018, and then he was hired so we could get Jim Boylan. Do you remember Jim Boylan? That guy was a real piece of shit. That guy sucked. Anyway, where was I in? The conversation was all about how much Fred Hoiberg had done to build a championship team. A former player for Iowa State returns to coach a struggling program to the promised land. You couldn't write it better if you tried. Although I think, shit. Although I think he fared far worse with coaching your Bulls. Sorry. Iowa State has a statue of her beloved coach, Johnny Orr, right in front of the building. Another coaching dynasties in sports aren't really unique, but we tend to think about them only when it comes to football. Dynasties in the NBA are about teams and players. I don't think that many conversations about the 90s Bulls center Phil Jackson. Dynasties in the NCAA are about coaching, and if you're going to get into college basketball, you have to think about it as a chess match between coaches, which is arguably less fun than the NBA, so I understand Bob's point completely. There's a similar conversation to be had with college football, but I think college football is so tied to the NFL at this point that it's a different beast. Happy for my boy, Lazard, go Cyclones. Thanks, Holden. Does that line up for you? Like, certainly, like, as an outsider that barely pays attention to college basketball, it certainly feels like people talk about the coaches more than anything else. Because it's a constant, right? Everything else, it changes so much season to season.
Yeah. It does. They sort of build a program. They sort of get guys to fit their system. They don't, yes. And they don't have access to the kind of transformative talents that it's like, I'm going to turn the keys to this team over to these guys. There's just fewer and fewer guys who fit that bill. It all makes sense. I think I think for me it is my window to drink that Kool-Aid and get really invested in that culture has kind of closed, right? Like I would need to care a lot more about like Purdue or IU than I could ever see myself doing. And so as much as like people love all this stuff, for me it is kind of, it is a little bit like, I'm not invested in these programs. And that's the thing that's missing is, you know, whatever goes on with the NFL, I will have the Bears to fall back on. And that's my point of entry. You know, what's UConn to me?
It did seem like the women's basketball stuff was able to establish some main characters, though, right? Like, I think you cannot.
Well, I don't think their talent pipeline has been like completely
decimated in the same way.
Yeah. Right. Like, I think if you still want to see the best women's basketball players, in the world, the ones who are not in the WNBA are in college ball. And so I think that's just a different animal right there, which is that, you know, there the relevance is more immediate. The level of play for women's basketball is higher, is kind of my feeling. I don't know that the WNBA pipeline has shifted outside college the way the NBA pipeline has. People can let me know. I'm curious if that has been reproduced.
It was interesting. I don't think we have time to get into all the bullshit discourse about civility that came out of the like women's basketball tournament, but like the ratings were huge. Do you have any sense? Obviously this is a little bit out of our depth, but like it did seem like maybe like this was sort of a moment for like women's athletic, women's basketball specifically. I don't know whether it lasts or whether it was whether it was like just you had this historic player, you know, on one team. And then like but you had a lot of characters. You had like emotional investment even for outsiders. And so maybe it was unique to this moment. Or is this something that allows like what has historically been a struggle for women's basketball to like get the popular culture sort of like side by side with men's basketball? I don't know, but it was interesting that how much it like, I don't know. I saw people talking about it that don't normally talk about stuff like that. And they had opinions about things that they shouldn't have opinions on. But in some ways, once you arrive to that status, you have hit a pop culture moment that like signifies relevancy in a way that is maybe like misplaced, but is nonetheless true.
Yeah, I think so. For me, the thing's a little bit weird about it is mostly that, to me, it's felt like women's college basketball has been pretty big for a while. So maybe this is just like, to me, maybe there has been a shift. We had it hit an inflection point. But it feels like to me for a little while, the women's tournament has probably been the more interesting one to follow. It's had a lot of really like dynamic tournaments, a lot of like photo finishes type stuff. And again, like maybe a slightly higher level of play relative to the pro game. But yeah, it's funny, like maybe this is just like the inflection point is. Even people who casually follow this stuff now have sort of gotten the message that the women's tournament is where it is at, as much, if not more, than the men's tournament. I do agree there's a little more attention to it. And maybe that is partly because, again, so much of the men's tournament is, this is just me speculating, but like, again, it's a lot of like marginal players who like college ball is it for them. You know, this is the end right. of the road. And so they sort of like are fit into systems. Whereas, you know, maybe in the women's tournament, you have more of those like big talents in the game who then, as we sort of saw, also have that little extra bit of swagger that comes with being really fucking good at a game. Knowing that, you know, the system will adapt to you, you know, because of your talent.
I meant to read this earlier. This one came in. This one from Anonymous. This one's for Rob. If it hasn't been said already, quote, mouse in the house refers to a mismatch wherein a big, Vooch, Embiid, etc., is being defended by a smaller guard in the paint. The guard is the, quote, mouse. The paint is the, quote, house. And the, quote, free cheese is the sweet satisfaction of getting an easy bucket over a smaller man. Stacey King is a madman, but this saying does actually map reasonably well to basketball. I haven't listened to the full pod yet, so my apologies if it gets cleared up later on. It did not, but thank you for writing in and clearing it up for all of us. That is delightful clarification.
I think what's thrown me is sometimes it feels like the mismatch is not as, like, sometimes it just feels like he's calling a mouse in the house. And I'm like, I don't know if this is the same degree of mismatch I've seen before, but uh-huh. either way, he does love to call it. But I think he is a generation of a player who, like, you know, his go-to complaint about the Bulls, he's a very good analyst when he puts his, you know, puts his shoulder into it. But I do sometimes suspect that his bias is a little more for like old school basketball, where like his go-to complaint is like, you know, if he sees a guy bat, like just not sort of physically push through, you know, defense on in the paint, he's like, you got to just put your back into that guy and just back him up. And every time somebody passes out of that, he's like, no, you just have to give him the get off me and you got to go. And it's like, I suspect that was maybe more the ethos of his day when you're in that position and maybe isn't the one of modern basketball. Though there are times where I'm like, Vooch, you need to like turn around and just like be bigger than that man. Like, come on, stop. Stop looking for outlet passes to like, let's re-rack this entire possession. Like, go and beat that man.
I mean, there was that game against the 76ers, which they ended up winning in overtime, but I think Embiid was one foul away from getting ejected, you know, or like hitting his, you know, the foul count. And it was just like, fucking get it. Like, somebody get in there and have him foul you. And he was in the game for like 7 minutes with like one foul to give. And like,
well, hold on. The refs didn't want to give it. Like, that was the other thing. It was so clear. The refs were like, let's like when you're a star and you got that, like when you're out of fouls to give, there is like a, do we really want to call that? And so they did let a lot go by, but there was an element of like, however good he is now the vulnerable point of this defense.
Right.
And you need to just like put your finger into it. And eventually he's going to foul out. And yeah, the Bulls don't always, aren't always built that way.
No,
they're a smaller team, but like, I, you know, watching and hearing, you know, Stace's complaints about him, as small as the lineup could be, they're also a team that sort of plays small, smaller than they are. Which is why, like, it is so striking when Andre Drummond is in, who is like a classic old school athletic big, and you see what he does for that team, and it's like, oh, this is just an element that is plainly missing. You know, a guy can go up and get those rebounds, but also physically has nothing to fear from the players around him.
How do we get Stacey King on the pod?
Well, he's got his own podcast.
I know. Crossover. Like, Stacey, do you want to come on our Waypoint
Plus? Do I have enough Stacey King in my life?
I want to be the mouse in the house, Rob. I want to be the mouse in the house. You can send in questions to future episodes of sports by writing in to gamingadvice.com with the title sports, or filling out the form that comes out over our Twitter feeds right before we record. But I think that is going to do it for this episode. Once again, our thanks to Jason Kebler from Motherboard for coming on and letting us know a little bit more about baseball, making us seem smarter than we are. That's always a delight. In the meantime, you can follow Waypoint on Twitter at Waypoint, on Twitch at twitch.tv/Waypoint, on YouTube at youtube.com/WaypointVice, and our writing at waypoint.vice.com. Rob and I, as you heard alluded to multiple times over the course of this podcast, play a little bit of MLB The Show. Did a little Cubs on Cubs so that the Cubs could both win and lose no matter what happened. And then tried to manage a team that essentially was just, how often could we attempt to trade for a generational two-way player and eventually maybe we'll get him? I don't know. You'll have to watch the stream to see if we could land such a talent.
Patrick, if we did not have jobs that we have to do and we can't do another motorsports style thing in our lives, but like I could see playing cooperative franchise mode being just infinite fun.
Yes.
In this game.
Like, absolutely.
The way they do the, like, put you in clutch high leverage situations, all the like building the ship in the bottle, the roster. And every time one of your guys suffers a mysterious injury that you have to compensate for, all sort of the rebuilding of the dynamics, like, oh my God, the fun. But also it is the work of a lifetime. This is why I'm not a sports game guy. It is like every year I get into MLB The Show, but I don't ever have the time to put into it to become like good at it, mm-hmm. or like do a multi-season franchise mode, because that is a, these sports games like this are built to be like your game. This is like the main game you play. And then there's other stuff you play on the side, but like, this is it. And that is like night and day from what we do and from what our sort of job is and the way our lives are built.
Yeah. But it seems really well made. I'm sure we'll talk up more about our experiences with it on the main podcast. But this episode is premiering ad-free on Waypoint Plus, which you can subscribe to and gain access to early episodes, exclusive episodes, ad-free episodes, and more at waypointplus.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick Klubik. Rob, how about you?
Oh, I'll just be hanging out watching the Bulls make this run. you can find me on my couch. Keeping an eye on the house, hoping a little mouse gets in there. And
no, don't say that. Don't cheese. Say that, Rob. That's, I feel like it's a cursed thing to say about your apartment.
Oh God, that's true.
No mouses in your houses.
That's true. I maybe left too much free cheese out over the last year.
fuck capitalism and bear down.